This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Local governments and housing authorities promote mixed-income housing developments as an equitable way to fight poverty. The idea is to prevent high concentrations of low-income residents. And the hope is that better schools and recreation areas give lower-income children a greater chance to move out of poverty. But a new paper in the Journal of Child Psychology and Psychiatry suggests that mixed-income housing has its own set of problems. The paper was written by a team of professors at Duke University. They found that low-income boys in particular in mixed-income communities are more likely than their peers to engage in antisocial behavior. Candace Odgers is a psychologist and an author of the report, and she joins us now to tell us more. Candace, welcome to the State of Things.
Good Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Interestingly enough, this study was done not in the U.S., but in England and Wales. So tell us more about how the study was done.
Yeah, so we had the opportunity to look at children who'd been growing up, so low-income children who'd been growing up alongside much more affluent peers, because there's been a long history of mixed-income housing in Britain. So we had a better chance to study it there than we would in the U.S., where we have very high rates of residential segregation. So we could look at how low-income kids fared when they grew up and went to school alongside kids with a lot more resources.
All right. And I guess one of the other distinctions you would make is that in Great Britain, there might be a less racial correlation between poverty and race. And so you might find more low-income white folks all living together. Racially, they're the same.
Yeah, so that's exactly true, is that the low-income children in our study, it was representative of Britain. The low-income children in our study were primarily white, so we didn't have this really tight coupling of race and poverty that you often find in the United States. And so we were really able to look at the effect of the economic composition of neighborhoods on these kids, aside from important issues related to racial and ethnic identity.
Right. So what did you find?
So we found that for our low-income kids, when they grew up what we called in the shadow of wealth, so when they grew up alongside more affluent neighborhoods, they actually engaged in more antisocial behaviors, so more fighting, lying, stealing, that type of thing, than their peers who grew up in more areas of more concentrated poverty, so grew up alongside kids who had similar resources to them.
Right. And so, and has this sort of research been done before? Does it match some of the other studies that have been done?
Yeah, so there was actually a pretty large-scale study in the United States called the Moving to Opportunity Study, which randomly assigned housing vouchers to low-income families. And some of those families took up those vouchers and moved to better neighborhoods, lower poverty neighborhoods. And they found the same thing among the boys in that study. So the boys who moved to more affluent neighborhoods actually ended up engaging in more crime and antisocial behavior 5 to 7 years on. And there was a recent publication in 2014 that showed what had happened 15 years on. And again, they were still engaging in higher rates of conduct disorder, higher rates of PTSD. And again, this seemed to be a male-specific effect. So the girls seemed to benefit in that study.
All right. Well, so what do you think is going on here?
So a couple things could be happening. So one of the suggestions from the authors of the MTO study was that there's just greater opportunity for crime. We don't particularly follow that line of logic. One of the things that we've really focused on is how children belong in a neighborhood, how they develop a sense of belonging, what it's like to be a low-income kid and try and make that transition to peers that might have more resources. So really these kind of social comparisons that take place among peers who might have more and how that affects your outlook on the future, how you think about your life chances, and ultimately how you behave.
Well, what do we know? I mean, the implication in what you just said is that you might see more acting out if something about my relative position in a social hierarchy, however it's perceived, is lower, I might be prone to act out more. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, and we see this across all types of outcomes, kind of physical health outcomes. The lower you are on a social ladder and how you compare yourself to others, you tend to do a little worse. And so, you know, it's important to understand how these kids in these mixed income communities, how they're seeing those around them, how they feel as though they belong. Can they actually access all those resources? So it's true they're going to better schools, but are they actually getting the benefits of those? Another colleague of ours, Rob Krosno, did a large scale study across the U.S. and found that low income children, when they attended school with middle and upper income kids, actually did worse. Right, in terms of all kinds of outcomes ranging from education to mental health. So I don't want to say that mixed income communities and schools are a bad thing for kids. I think we all kind of strive to create those types of settings for children, but there are situations in which they work and others in which they don't seem to work. And I think we need to understand what is it about these types of communities that can work for kids and what are some characteristics of these communities that might, you know, hold kids back or low-income kids back or not really provide those same opportunities.
I'm going to ask you just that question in a minute, but the first thing I want to know about is what you think accounts for the gender difference? Why do girls not do as badly and in some cases better?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And a lot of people have studied this in depth. One of the things that happens in high-risk neighborhoods is that parents tend to police the behavior of their girls a little bit more. And so in that Moving to Opportunity study, researchers actually went back and conducted some interviews to figure out why it is that girls might be doing better in this move to a better place. And, you know, some of the reasons were being in the home a little bit more, so not being exposed to outside conditions as much. It may be that girls have some more social skills in terms of being able to adapt to that age and extract resources from these communities. We don't know, but what is clear is across a lot of different studies, the effect of neighborhood seems to be a bit stronger for boys than girls.
All right, so where does it work? There have been models and there have been studies about mixed income neighborhoods where the outcomes are better. What makes it work?
Yeah, so I think, a couple things. I think that people look to mixed income communities and schools as a solution to what has been a very long-standing problem of concentrated poverty. And the important thing from our perspective is to not stop at just the creation of those communities, but to try and figure out how they're working, for whom they're working, and under what conditions. And, there's different levels that you can target. One is, physical spaces. So are there shared community spaces in which people can come together and kind of create those social bonds, kind of bring diverse populations together in a productive and cohesive way versus clear markers of separation? And I think the New York example of the poor door is a prime example of a physical way to structure communities that doesn't work. So having a building in which the rich and the poor live together, but requiring the poor to actually enter a separate door. I mean, that's an extreme example, but, you know, thinking of everything from the physical spaces to creating community at the social level to really working with individual children and understanding, you know, what their sense of belonging is within that community and finding ways to improve it.
I wonder how important a role the school plays in all this. I know that that's beyond the scope of your particular research, but we've seen so much research and data now on how particularly children of color are misdiagnosed. And so children who should probably be in either normal or gifted programs end up in learning disabled classes. And the outcomes from being misplaced are very poor, and they correlate very closely with some horrible outcomes. We've seen a lot of data on that. How important is the school experience and sensitivity to this diversity to making it work?
Yeah, so clearly schools are an incredibly important place for our children. They spend countless hours in schools throughout the day. It's a really formative kind of structure. And they're, you know, in places like North Carolina, we've seen the historical effects of segregation and the harmful effects that creates. And creating more diverse communities can really be a key to producing excellence, but there's a way that has to happen in which the communities in which children come from, that's respected and those families are integrated. And so education, you know, funding, constant learning from the experiences of the kids, from the teachers, from the community, and bringing those all together.
So you're not hoping that the conclusion that we should come to from your report is that segregation is better for all of us, right?
No, that's the exact conclusion I would not want you to come to from the report. I think what we need to understand are the conditions in which mixed communities work. So what needs to be present in these spaces, in these communities, in these children's lives for them to actually benefit from access to these greater resource schools, neighborhoods, et cetera.
Are there examples, other places where it's done pretty well?
Yeah, so I think a lot of cities are thinking very seriously about this. Chicago has some nice examples. There's a lot of community activists and housing programs that are thinking carefully about this and starting to collect real data on how residents are faring when they come together. So there are model programs, and I think it'll be important for us as we, you know, for example, in Durham is a very integrated and diverse community, that we, you know, don't reinvent the wheel, that we take a second and we look to see what has worked elsewhere? You know, in what settings are people really feeling as though they have a sense of belonging and ownership over the physical spaces and the communities that they belong to? And how it's affecting residents at all levels, right? And so one of the concerns that's always raised when you talk about mixed-income communities is, well, sure, it might benefit the lower-income kids, but what does it do to the upper, those in the upper class? And so really understanding at each kind of level of social class for each cultural and ethnic group, for each stakeholder in those communities, kind of what's the benefit?
I wonder if there's a correlation, because we know that in Wake County, when the diversity plan was in effect, it was one of the best school systems in the country, and the outcomes were better for everybody, it seemed, in all the research. Does that correlate to anything that you found?
Yeah, so I think that's kind of a general principle, and the idea, and this comes from a lot of cross-national research, is that in unequal societies, everyone does worse, right? And that's the type of principle that's guided things like the spirit level by Wilkinson and Pickett, where they looked across different nations and found that nations where you have a more egalitarian distribution of resources, that everyone does better, from those in the lowest, you know, 5th percent to those in the highest. And that principle is kind of extended downward. So the key is, you know, how do we get there in a structure where resource allocation may be unlikely to change to that type of model of distribution?
All right, Candace, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks.
Candace Odgers is a professor of public policy and psychology and neuroscience at Duke University. You can find a link to her research at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, we go behind the butcher's counter at Cliff's Meat Market in Carrboro. This is the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us.